April 20th, I believe, aren't we?
21st.
21st. Ooh, moving fast. And we will open a hearing on House Bills 3030, 3031, 32, 33, 34, 35, and also Senate Bill 736. So I'm going to, I think, call first on Bill Linden, if he will come. He's under a little time pressure for a Senate committee, so we'll ask Bill if he'll come forward and give us your best.
Mr. Chairman, for your record, Bill Linden, representing the Oregon Metals Industry Council, and I very much appreciate your indulgence in terms of my schedule. I'm supposed to be in three different places right now, so I'll be quick. I wanted to testify in support of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3031 and talk a bit to the underlying bill as well. The Metals Industry Council is composed of companies across the state of Oregon, including such industry leaders as Boeing, Esko, Gunderson, Schnitzer, Wachang. And metals is a very important sector of our economy, as you well know, and it's a growing sector. They've been rebounding strongly from some of the economic difficulties that Oregon faced in this last decade, and they're a very vibrant, as I say, expanding sector of our economy. The Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 3031 would continue a very important tax credit program for the metals industry, the Pollution Control Tax Credit. Essentially what these amendments do, in addition to including in the definition of a pollution control facility a biofuel processing plant or production plant, extend the sunset on this program to 2016. It was scheduled to sunset December 31 of this year. And again, it's been a program that's been longstanding and of great benefit to the metals industry and to various other industries, including the high-tech industry, and is a proven winner in terms of attracting expansion and business to the state. The bill does several other things as well, or the amendments do. Mr. Ledger gave you the background on the chipping issue, the wood chipping issue, so I won't go into that. But it also provides for the applicability of the tax credit at the 50% level when you have an applicant that's certified under what's called the green standard, and 35% in other cases. So I just wanted to have an opportunity to get on the record, indicate OMIC's support for the underlying bill and for the Dash 1 amendments, and answer any questions you might have about how this program operates and what it means to the particular sector that I'm representing today.
Could you briefly explain the green standard?
Well, if you look at page 11 of the amendments, starting in line 2, you'll see the 50% tax credit level applies if the applicant certified under what's called the International Organization for Standardization Standard ISO 1401, which is essentially, as I read it, a green standard, a green permit, and that's defined in ORS 468501. It has some other criteria in there. For example, the facility is a non-point source or is regulated as a confined animal feeding operation. It's used for material recovery or recycling. But those are the elements that a facility would have to comply with in order to be eligible for that particular level of tax credit.
To get the green permit.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, other questions? Representative Byrd.
Bill, there are also dash 2s and dash 3s to this that seem to be just housekeeping to 3031.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Girard, I was just handed the Dash 2s and 3s. I think the Dash 2s delete language in the original bill that provided that, I think if you go to the dash twos, if you go to page four, you'll see that the dash twos delete sections 3, 4, and 6, which relate to field sanitation and straw utilization. And the dash threes again, I apologize, I just, as I say, was handed these as I walked up here. I believe the dash threes they would delete, if you go down to line 40, on page 2, I think these are purely housekeeping. They relate to some of the language in their dealing with farm storage facilities. But you might want to have the people who have these drafted explain those in more detail. I'm flying blind.
Just wanted to see if you had any objections to.
I don't believe we do, Representative Gerard.
Okay, any other questions? Hearing none.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, I'll call Dave Nelson and Charles Carlson. Is Dan Flynn here?
David. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify on this package of bills. I really want to address House Bill 3031. My name is Dave Nelson. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Oregon Seed Council and also represent the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. The Oregon Seed Council represents Oregon's grass seed industry and is a federation of the five grass seed commodity commissions, which represent most of the species produced in the state. The Oregon Seed Trade Association, which represents the 55 or so seed companies that are producing and marketing seed around the world. A number of grass seed organizations, the Turf Grass Breeders Association and the Agricultural Fiber Association, which is the organization of straw baling, marketing, and exporting companies. Grass seed production is Oregon's third largest agricultural commodity in terms of economic value and is produced on over 500,000 acres in the Willamette Valley, Central Oregon, the Columbia Basin, and Union County. We produce nearly 800 million pounds of seed with a farm gate value in excess of $330 million annually. Grass seed produced in Oregon represents about 60% of the world's supply of grass seed adapted to temperate climates around the world. Oregon seed is sold in every state in the United States and to over 60 countries around the globe. Seed growers burn fields to harvest after harvest to control weeds, diseases, and other pests from 1946 until the phase down began in 1991. The end result was a statutory reduction in open burning from 250,000 acres annually down to 40,000 acres in the valley floor and a few more acres in the steep terrain in the Silverton Hills. Pollution control tax credits have played an enormous role in facilitating development of alternative practices. While the grass seed industry is not a huge user of pollution control investment tax credits, the tax credits are an important element to every individual farm and to straw balers who are forced to invest in alternative equipment to remove straw from fields following harvest. PTCs have been used to defray costs of straw sheds, balers, bale handling equipment, presses, and other things to get the straw to market or to deal with it if it's not going to a market. The grass seed straw export market has grown to the point where it is now between 550 and 600,000 tons annually. That's 25,000 containers that go out of the Willamette Valley every summer. 60% of that goes to Japan, 39% goes to Korea, and 1% goes to Taiwan. However, the straw market is and always has been a tenuous activity. Competition is fierce in the Japanese market. Competitors include California rice straw and Sudan grass hay, Australian grass and oat hay, and now Chinese rice straw. China, as you know, is much closer to Japan than we are. Our exporters had an edge over China because of China's hoof-and-mouth disease problem and the Japanese aversion to importing hoof-and-mouth disease into Japan. Within the last 2 years, however, China has built 5 to 7 new fumigation plants to treat Chinese rice straw so that they have access to the Japanese market. Within the last 2 years, Chinese rice straw has become a significant price and volume competitor in the Japanese market. The market for perennial ryegrass straw has declined significantly over the past 2 years, and marketers are in Japan and Korea today, as we speak, trying to restore that market. The point is that there are no sure deals in straw utilization, and it's much too early to declare victory in the pursuit of straw utilization. Remember trying to spin straw into gold? What was that old fairy tale that was out there? Also remember that the exported straw market represents only half of the million tons of straw that we deal with in the grass seed industry after harvest. Investment tax credits for pollution control plant and equipment continue to be an important element in our effort to find a way to grow grass seed in the quantity and quality and of the quality that is demanded in world markets. If the legislature is trying to entice grass seed growers to grow biofuel crops, it seems to me that the approach of sticking your finger in their eye first by taking away their investment tax credits and pollution control equipment isn't really a good way to begin the conversation. Every other business in Oregon has access to tax credits for investment in pollution control plant and equipment. Why single out the grass seed industry to eliminate their eligibility? There's been a lot of discussion about growing canola for biofuel production. We've studied a lot of proposals for alternative crops in the grass seed industry over the last 30 years. Grass seed farmers grew canola in the 1980s. I talked to one farmer who grew quite a bit of it up in the Silverton Hills in the late 1980s. He contracted for 13 cents a pound for the stuff, sold it for 6. He said his comment was, "You won't find me at the head of the line to grow canola." We also, as I said, have played around with a lot of other crops.
We'll get to that issue later.
Freudian slip there. We grew a bunch of flax for canvas production, and he said that he grew some flax too. Finally hauled it out of the shed and used it to start a fire on some brush piles he had up back in the back of the place. We support the House Bill 31-2 amendments that delete Section 4 of House Bill 3031. That's the section that eliminates the grass seed industry's access to pollution control tax credits. Now let me offer some comments on behalf of the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association. I happen to have two clients that are probably some of the more offensive environmental issues that we have to deal with, and that's smoke and smell. And everybody loves a dairy farm except for the manure. Dairy farmers have invested heavily in water quality protection and face similar investments in odor reduction and in methane reduction in the very near future. Pollution control tax credits are very important to dairy producers and ease the cost of compliance with these regulations. As you have heard it many times, farmers cannot set the price of their commodities, so they cannot pass on the cost of compliance. They simply absorb it. Some producers are investing in methane digesters to process manure and generate electricity, and that significantly reduces the odor. The way they work is that the manure is captured in a closed tank. The methane gas comes off and powers an engine that's attached to a generator. The generator is connected to a power line. The end result is a significantly reduced odor, much lower methane emissions in the atmosphere, and electricity to power users. Bioelectricity, a win-win for everybody. We urge you to include energy production from dairies in the package. I think it is covered in most of those packages, but I haven't talked to Mr. Draney about the detail of all of the elements that go into that. We urge you to keep that in your mind. If the package moves ahead, we'd like to make sure that that's included. So thank you for your consideration of these comments.
Thank you very much, David.
Chair Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Charles Carlson. I'm president of Cascade Grain Products. I'm here to support all the renewable bills before you, and especially Bill 3033. Renewable fuel standard is essential for the fledgling bioindustry in this state to grow. Credits and incentives help establish a business, but the long-term success requires a viable market. You know, right now, ethanol is not sold directly to an end retail market. It has to be blended by the petroleum industry for that final distribution to take place. The petroleum industry will say they don't want mandates, but in actuality, there exists a 100% mandate for the consumer to have to fill up at the gas station. There's not another viable distribution for that person to fill up their car, so what we're here is to ask for a portion of that market. Are there other benefits for using ethanol? Of course, there's many environmental benefits for ethanol have been kicked around long enough. We don't need to rehash them here. But I look for major benefits as far as the reduction in the dependency of foreign oil and a knowledge of a safe, affordable, and renewable domestic fuel source. Ethanol is not the only answer, the only solution to our petroleum requirements. Even within the ethanol industry, our ethanol from grain can only account for about 9 to 11 billion gallons annually. We have to turn to cellulose, and that, they estimate, can create another 20 billion gallons, whether it's corn stover, whether it's ryegrass straw, or whatever cellulosic market. Then we can get to a 20% blend similar to what Brazil has. And I just take a partial quote out of an article out of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. In Brazil, by law, all gasoline contains a minimum of 25% alcohol. Yet ethanol is so popular, it actually accounts for 40% of all vehicle fuel. By 2007, 100% of all new Brazilian cars may be able to run on 100% ethanol. Their flex vehicles are full flex vehicles from 100% ethanol to 100% alcohol. They are also working very hard to develop the biodiesel industry. Quote here, within 15 years, expects to substitute biodiesel for 20% of its conventional diesel. Back in the mid-90s, Brazil ended its ethanol subsidies. Nevertheless, with world oil prices hovering around $55 a barrel, the price of ethanol today is only half that of gasoline, even on a worldwide basis, not only in the U.S. Since its inception, Brazil ethanol program has displaced imported oil worth $120 billion. This is comparable to a savings of almost $2 trillion for a U.S.-sized economy. Everybody looked at the Minnesota plan, so let's take a further quote from there. In the mid-1980s, Minnesota farmers successfully petitioned the legislature to restructure the state incentive to encourage in-state production of ethanol. The incentive came as a direct payment of 20 cents per gallon. There were limits. The ethanol had to be produced in Minnesota. The incentive was available only for the first 15 million gallons produced each year, and it only lasted for 10 years. Because of the incentive's time limit, within the next year to more than half of all of the state ethanol production will receive no incentives. You might also ask, why don't we wait around for a federal renewable fuel standard? The federal government has taken up this legislation for many years and has been unable to pass it. Although it does appear more likely this time, its success is not guaranteed. Previous bills have included provisions to eliminate the oxygenate requirements in reformulated gas, and also had a credit trading program that would allow for environmental obligations to be switched from other parts of the country by using that credit trading program. That solves the problem in a legal way, but it doesn't do the true justice on what should be done on the environmental side. The governor's Renewable Energy Action Plan and the Oregon Strategy for Greenhouse Gas Reduction includes the use of ethanol and biodiesel to meet the goals of these plans. This is a time to enact a renewable fuel standard in Oregon that would ensure that Oregon receives its share of biofuels and not wait for the federal government to enact a program that may not extend the benefits to this state. Recently, even the Montana legislature, even with their refining assets in states, passed Senate Bill 293 that once ethanol production in that state reached 40 million gallons, and a 10% ethanol blend will take place in that state. The bill also included production incentives for local ethanol plants, and all other states are also stepping up to that plate to ensure they have renewable fuel sources. Isn't it time for Oregon to also step up to that plate? Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
My senior moment, excuse me. The question is, you were talking about the amount of grass seed in the Willamette Valley, grass seed acreage in Willamette Valley. 500,000, is that what I heard you say, 500,000 acres?
A little over 500,000 acres, Representative Jensen. Probably, I'm going to tell you, like 470,000 acres here in the valley, another 10,000 acres in Jefferson County, probably 7,000 or 8,000 acres in the Columbia Basin up in Umatilla County, and another 10,000 or 12,000 acres in Union County.
Okay. That's the amount that's in production every year?
Correct. That's right.
In the grass seed industry, is there rotation? Is there need for rotation on the field?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, if you go back through history, if you just look at the model of the Willamette Valley, we grew something on the order of 200,000 acres of wheat, 220,000, 30,000, 40,000 acres of grass seed. But gradually, as the price of wheat dropped off and it became more of a world commodity, it shifted over to more grass seed production. Then as the canneries went out of business, you think there was 30 or 40,000 acres in Woodburn from a cannery that went out, I think it was a Bird's Eye processing plant up there, closed about 15 years ago. That shifted over to grass seed production. When AgriPac went out of business, a lot of that ground went into grass seed production. There is a value in rotation. Now, you also have choices that farmers can make. They can do a chemical fallow on their ground to clean it up. Primarily, it's a break between species production to meet certification standards for marketing a certified crop. Do they need, will they grow something at a loss in order to have a rotation crop? Likely not.
You took 7,000 acres in Columbia Basin. There are obviously a lot more than 7,000 acres in the Columbia Basin. It could grow grass seed. Mm-hmm. But that's about all there is in production. How many acres are in the Willamette Valley, total acres, that you could grow a biofuel source?
Well, I think Chair Anderson, Representative Jensen, you kind of qualified the question there at the end. How many acres are there in production, and then how many would grow biofuels crops? It's hard to say. Let's say that there are 1,000,000 acres in the Willamette Valley that may be in cultivated production or would be cultivatable. Some of that's in pasture currently. A lot of it's in row crop. A lot of it's in clover seed. A lot of it's in, there's some grain crops grown primarily over in Yamhill County, Polk County, Clackamas County. And as I said, somewhere around 460,000, 70,000 acres in grass seed that's in the 9 Willamette Valley counties. How much would be convertible or would be used to grow a biofuel crop? I haven't heard a lot of farmers say they want to grow canola. What other biofuels crops are there? If you look at oil seed production, we do a little canola up in your country. We do a little meadow foam in the Willamette Valley. There are no other oil seed crops that I can think of right off the top of my head that would be other than niche markets like lavender and things like that that are used specifically for a very narrow purpose. There are some of those. So I guess my sense is that economics are going to lead the way. The science is going to lead the way. Are farmers going to grow crops at a loss to generate an oil seed? Probably not. Right now, let me just add, right now it's hard to get bankers to let you try to grow something that you think you can make a profit at.
Let alone something you don't know.
Yeah. Well.
Well, just a little bit with this, and I don't know enough to be talking about this, and the only way I know is start asking questions. It's my understanding that with canola, at any rate, if we stay with that just for a moment here, that you're really looking at a 4 or 5 year rotation with canola, that it requires that kind of rest on the field before you want to replant. And it also, my understanding, takes about 200,000 acres of canola to fuel one of the plants that would be of size such. That would mean we'd need somewhere in probably the 800,000 to a million acres committed to canola on at least once every 4 or 5 years. Sort of thing. And I'm just trying to get a picture of how this plays out as far as the market is concerned.
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, I'm trying also, as you were talking, to remember the arable basin in Oregon. And we have differences here as why we produce grass seed. We're warm and wet in the winter. We're dry and low humidity in the summer. The Midwest, Central Canada, they get irrigated every week. From there, there's no cost. Umatilla Electric isn't involved in supplying the juice that run the pump. So we don't have a very competitive advantage over them. We do have a competitive advantage over grass seed, in producing grass seed, because we don't need processed heat in the summer to dry it. We have the sun. So there would be, if the 250,000 acres or the 200,000 acres is correct, there would be a requirement for about a fifth of the land in the Willamette Valley, or perhaps about a fifth of the arable land in eastern Oregon, if you take a million acres each side, to be devoted to canola or to an oilseed crop.
Mm-hmm.
Canola is the only one I know that produces an adequate supply of oil. It's about 46% oil in the seeds. Soybeans don't do here. We've looked at a variety of soybeans. We looked at Sweetie soybeans. The temperature curves are upside down for producing
the soybean route. We've got enough soybeans in the Midwest that they start to be questionable.
I also read an interesting article that the University of North Dakota was now starting a research program to see if canola was useful as a biodiesel feedstock. So, you know, it's nice to talk about, but they haven't done the research to know that it is how well it works. We presume it works, but apparently nobody's really tried it.
Thank you very much, Dave. I'm just trying to fill in some of the blanks in my mind if we're dealing with it. Thank you.
Representative Gregg.
I'm going to just follow up on the area that Representative Jensen was doing. But the disparity in price with the where in the state would farmers want to grow canola or oilseed crops?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, the Columbia Basin has been the place of choice. We tried a little here for seed stock and for oil production in the late 80s. It died out very quickly. Moved to the Columbia Basin. There's been discussion of construction of plants in the extraction plants somewhere up there. Frankly, that discussion's been going on since the 80s. I don't know of an extraction plant up there. Two kinds of extraction plants: a screw press and a hexane solvent extraction facility. I don't know that with the hydrocarbon emissions limitations on hexane extraction facilities, if one would ever be licensed in the state of Oregon.
Thank you. I retained about half of that.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, that's intense.
Just dealing with some of my finest friends in the Columbia Basin, the really only viable acreage there is the irrigated acreage. The production off of the dry land farms would probably be inadequate to be a real viable crop for them to produce, but possibly off the irrigated land it could be. But of course you cut down on total acreage here significantly. One of the things, if this whole biodiesel thing would catch on, of course, and you could do away with some of this bucket for bucket out of the Columbia River. As I look at some of the advocates for this, we could add a lot more acreage in eastern Oregon in the Columbia Basin if we could get the irrigation permits to do so.
All right, staff question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for Mr. Carlson. Once you start an ethanol production facility using a particular feedstock, how easy would it be to switch production to a different kind of feedstock? You're proposing to use corn, for example, if some kind of cellulosic material that's homegrown here in Oregon became economically viable, would your plant be capable of processing that without significant retrofitting of the plant?
Well, since it isn't fully commercialized, it's a little difficult to say at this point in time when you are on a cellulosic side. It would be easier to switch, like, say, from a corn to a sorghum or to another, a wheat, for example. But on cellulose, yes, you got to break it. It's another place you got to figure out additional storage. One thing on the cellulose, it takes a lot more storage space because you have to put the material out there, and then you got to break it down to the glucose. Once you get it to the glucose level, then it becomes very similar in its process. But this plant would be a lot easier to switch from corn to sorghum to a stock white wheat, which is one of the highest starch wheats.
Okay, thank you. You mentioned Minnesota had a mandated program, and I believe Montana has recently put in some kind of a mandate. I haven't heard much about that.
Right. Yeah, the Montana mandate just passed this week, and they have to have 40 million of ethanol production in the state for it to kick into a 10% renewable fuel standard. I believe Hawaii is about the same. I don't know their level of production.
Are there other states that are producing ethanol that don't have a mandate?
Oh, yeah. Well, Iowa, for example, doesn't have a mandate, but they use it a lot in that area. The one that has always been shown as the plan is the Minnesota plan, because they went in and put a mandate in before they had ethanol production there.
But the other states can function without a mandate.
At the current time, they are, although many of the states are looking at mandates also.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much. Let me call next Jim Walsh here. I may not have made it back. Dan Clem. All right. Could I have Paul Romaine, Brian Doherty, and Bob Russell come forward?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine, attorney in Portland representing the Oregon Petroleum Association. And I'm going to testify to all the bills as a lump. That's what I call them, a lump. And basically what we in the petroleum industry are concerned about, we use ethanol, we sell biodiesel. We're actively involved in the business, but we are absolutely adamantly opposed to any mandates. And the reason for it is very simple. We're not really sure what the consequences are of all this. Ethanol, for example, there's very mixed science coming out now. Mr. Doherty will tell you a little bit about some more specifics, but in California, I believe the Lung Association and the Sierra Club actually has been opposed to the ethanol mandate. The California Air Resources Board CARB draft report, which has not been published, basically questions ethanol. It has some negative consequences. Now, it has a lot of positive consequences. We use it in fuel blends. It does cut down on gas mileage, so even though you might have a little more in there, you might be using a little more fuel. Biodiesel, the problem is there is no science on biodiesel right now. We don't know exactly what the consequences are. In fact, as Mr. Doherty will point out, there are some interesting things that are happening now with governmental entities that have gone to biodiesel and are now backing away from it. But that's not to say it's not something that we want in the future. What we're saying is now's not the time to go mandate something that you may have to come back and redo. Now's the time to get everybody together and to study the problem and find out what it is that we should be doing. Look at the science from an objective standpoint. Look at what's available out there and make some intelligent decisions when you have all the information. Right now, you're under a lot of pressure during the legislative session. You know, usually the best way to kill things is throw them into an interim committee, and I realize that, you know, that may be a suspect strategy. However, this is something that truly deserves study. It is something we may jump on, we may love. We don't know, but we're scared to death about it. We would prefer, if you decided to mandate something, that you mandate a clean air level, some kind of particulate or whatever, some clean air standard, and then leave it to us to get there. Don't tell us how to get there. Tell us what you want, and we'll get there somehow. But don't put us in a situation where we're locked in to using something that, A, becomes very difficult to find, may skyrocket in price, and really may have some questionable characteristics that we just really don't understand yet. Mr. Doherty will jump in. I'll let the he's smarter than I am. He can answer all the questions, too.
Good afternoon, Chair Anderson, members of the committee. Brian Doherty with the law firm Miller Nash, and I'm here representing the Western States Petroleum Association, which is an association of about 90 petroleum exploration, production, marketing, refining companies in the six western U.S. states. One thing I wanted to say about the industry, and what I've handed you in my testimony, if you look at the second packet, it talks about ultra-low sulfur diesel or clean diesel. What I want you to know is that this industry has been very good at following the science, and we have a great working relationship with DEQ and other agencies because we work with the science, and where the science tells you to go in a direction, we've been able to do it. The news is for you is that Oregon is in attainment for both carbon monoxide, wintertime air, and for summertime ozone. California has a much different picture with non-attainment areas throughout many cities in California. That's why California has an ethanol demand of over 1 billion gallons a year. Oregon has not had to use oxygenates to meet its standards. It had it in Portland for 10 years, and it's continuing until 2007. Despite a mandate in Portland for over these 10 years, not one ethanol plant got built, not one Oregon farmer was benefiting. This mandate was not necessary to meet the standards. We've had a great success story in carbon monoxide in that we have now reduced Oregon's level to 40% of the federal permissible exposure level. It happened because of fleet turnover, catalytic converters, and fuel-injected engines. And it can continue; it will continue to go down without any oxygenate mandate. I want to say this. We will be blending ethanol and biodiesel in our fuels for the foreseeable future. They are a part of the energy mix, and part of the energy mix is going to stay in the United States and, I believe, in Oregon. So we are the number one buyer and blender and user of both of these products. We work closely with those industries. I am here to testify to tell you we have no objection to House Bills 3030, 3031, 3032, and Senate Bill 736. We are opposed to the mandates in 3033 and 3034, and we're opposed to the pump fee in 3035. And I'd be glad to address those questions. One of the things I want to point out is there is a tremendous amount of subsidies going on right now. Federally, you have 51 cents a gallon for ethanol. You have a dollar a gallon for crop-based biodiesel. You have 50 cents a gallon for food waste biodiesel. You put on top of this property tax exemptions in 3030, pollution control tax credits in 3031, income and corporate excise tax credits in 3032 of 5 and 4 cents a gallon for these fuels. That is a lot of subsidy. The Midwest made their market with subsidies, not with a mandate. Minnesota is the only state that has that mandate. It's the only state that has a biodiesel mandate. Hawaii has a mandate, but it's production-based. Montana just passed something that would wait until you have production. We do not have ethanol production in Oregon. We have very little biodiesel production in Oregon, and it's more of a small stills, if you want to call them that, that are located in the state. the important thing is, why go to a mandate when what can happen is you have a very volatile market? And I want to just bring up a couple of points that I think you should think about in determining what your policy is. We think it's a public policy decision on tax credits. So if you wish to do that, that's your choice. But we believe a mandate creates an artificial marketplace. And that is creates something where supply and demand stops working as it should. Right now, we are blending. Our companies, Mr. Romaine's companies, are blending ethanol in Oregon with no mandate. A considerable amount is being blended right now today in Oregon. Why? Because those subsidies are doing what they're supposed to do. With the price of gasoline where it is, it makes economic sense to blend this. But there is science on ethanol that has it's had some maturation, and we're able now to understand better its characteristics and how it works. In biodiesel, it's a very fledgling industry. It does have some ASTM standards, unlike my point I make in item number 6. But the ASTM standards are woefully inadequate for blenders to really get a quality, consistent product that we can blend into gasoline so that when you drive away in your car, you're happy with what's happening, and we don't have separation issues or other problems that you can have with blending these fuels. Ethanol is very mature. Remember when we started ethanol, you started having this water in your gas tanks? It was really separation of the ethanol and the gasoline. We finally got down to standards where we can blend it appropriately. You're not hearing those problems of people saying they've got water in their gas. It's working now. But there are properties here that I think you should look at. And I've listed them on items 1 through 10 and the next page, the next two pages, and I won't go over all of them. I do want to point out one item. Why would Oregon consider a mandate when California is asking the federal government to discontinue the oxygenate mandate in California and is joined by the Sierra Club and the American Lung Association, family physicians, and others? There's a reason. There's a coordinating research council study that just came out. And I want to say this. There is conflicting evidence on all this, but it's all the more reason to go carefully into this area. But the Coordinating Research Council report and the CARB draft report that's California Air Resource Board that came afterwards says that there's over 70, I believe it's 45 tons per day of volatile organic compounds are being added to California's state inventory by ethanol blended fuels. And this is coming out of permeation of this product before ignition through hoses and other events. This is something that's new that the industry did not understand before. And they're concerned about they're not getting enough improvement in the tailpipe to overcome this. There are good properties for both of these fuels. They have good effects. Biodiesel reduces many pollutants, but it also increases nitrous oxide emissions. These are all things that people need to understand. There's no perfect fuel, although I heard some very interesting things about these fuels in the prior meetings that made me think I may want to put it in my coffee and use it for my toothpaste. But it needs testing. We need to have national testing standards to understand truly what these things do so you know what you're doing, what you're putting into your automobiles. I'll let it rest there. I think I'd be glad to answer any questions. There is a federal mandate of over 5 billion gallons in the federal energy bill for ethanol biodiesel products. If you're going to do a mandate, it's better to do it on a national level than a patchwork of states. And so that would be what I would encourage. And just again, let you know, these industries have worked and flourished without mandates. These incentives can work. And we'll be here to work with you on crafting any legislation that may come out here, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
You mentioned that we need national testing standards. Isn't that what ASTM or some of the gasoline standards are now?
Yes, and diesel, excuse me, Mr. Chair, diesel, gasoline, and ethanol all have very stringent and very accurate ASTM standards that tell you much more than what you have for biodiesel. Biodiesel has a B100, which means 100% biodiesel, mm-hmm, ASTM standard. It is, according to the people I talk to in our industry, woefully inadequate for someone that wants to look at blending it. And it needs much more development. I also think you need these scientific studies to understand better what you're getting not only out of the tailpipe in these fuels, but what is going on before as part of the blending process and the delivery systems, and to see what we have. We have a very good product.
Let me ask you about that again. We said B100, as that's the one that's been tested, but it's inadequate for blending? Or
that is the one that has an ASTM standard. And my understanding is that from the fuels industry, it is woefully inadequate for them to use that and say, that is how I can do it when I want to blend B5, B20, B10. It needs more accurate standards that it's meeting so that the product you buy here or in Boise or in the Midwest is the same, and it can be mixed with the conventional fuels and work in the same way.
If I put, say, unleaded fuel, unleaded regular, into my automobile, and I get, I would get about 24 to 25, 250 miles, can I get the same mileage generally if I put a blend of ethanol and gasoline?
Mr. Chair, my understanding of a E10 or ethanol 10% mix is you have about a 3% loss in fuel economy. So you do have lost miles per gallon based on that mix, on an E10 mix.
So we're gaining in cost less, but we get less efficient, less power.
Today, it may be cost less. Who knows about tomorrow? I think it's a volatile market all the way around, and that's, again, where these incentives allow the market to work and allows the flexibility that a mandate doesn't. A mandate stays whether we go inverse in terms of the cost of these various fuels or we stay the same, but a fuel incentive package allows you to meet the market at the most efficient cost to the consumer.
Okay. Thank you very much.
If I could, let me just, there was one other point that I wanted to make, which was that that bastion of conservatism, the Eugene Register Guard, editorialized in March, basically against doing the, urging caution in this area. The reason for it is that it seemed to the editorial writers at the Eugene Register Guard that you were spending 10 cents to make 5 cents. And that gets into, again, studying the thing. How much money do you want to put into this? How much encouragement do you need when you're really not sure of what the stuff does? And isn't this a time to truly go slowly, understand it a little better, and then maybe we have the best thing in the world? But again, we urge you to stay away from the mandates. Thank you.
May I just add one point? Brian Doherty again, as we'll end it, and Bob will get a chance to testify.
No, I'm going to testify some more.
I did send you that ultra-low sulfur diesel packet, and I want to tell you that what we're doing all over the U.S. is what's called ultra-low sulfur diesel must begin by June 30th, 2006. All new diesel engines thereafter, the 2007 model year, Bob can testify this, are going to have particulate traps. This is a very good program. We're going to be moving diesel from over 500 some parts up to 500 parts per million in particulate matter down to less than 15 parts per million. And I think you're going to see a dramatic change in that fuel composition and in the cleaner exhaust emissions with or without these additional fuels.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I'm here to testify in opposition to House Bill 3033, the mandate. And I'm not going to go through all of my testimony because you've taken a lot of testimony, and I'm going to try not to repeat anything you've heard already. But I would like to make a few quick points and sort of picking up where Mr. Doherty left off. The trucking industry has been working with the Environmental Protection Agency for some time to clean up the exhaust from on-highway diesel engines. The first new generation of diesel engines came out in October of 2002, and those engines dramatically reduced NOx emissions. As Mr. Doherty said, next year we're going to low sulfur diesel.
And then in 2007, we go to the next generation of diesel engines, which has particulate traps that will dramatically reduce, again, the emissions from on-highway diesel engines. And then in 2010, we have the final phase-in of the new diesel engines. And there's sort of a couple of points around all of that. Right now, the diesel engine manufacturers, their research and development departments are sort of overloaded, working on these new EPA standards and getting these new engines ready for the marketplace. To impose an additional requirement on their research and development departments at this time, I'm afraid would be the straw that broke the camel's back. Second point is the trucking industry, because we don't know state borders. We operate all over the place. We're much more amenable to regulation or requirements that come at the federal level. And that means sure the market, there's a level playing field for everybody and for each of the states, quite frankly. And when we talk about increasing the cost of fuel, last week we hit the fourth all-time record for the highest diesel fuel cost in this country's history. And it keeps going up and up. If we have a mandate, we're very concerned that that's going to add to that increased cost of diesel. Now, certainly that's a hardship for the trucking industry, without question, because at least initially we're eating that cost. But I think more importantly, it's a hardship on the economy. And if a single state has a mandate and diesel costs are much higher than in neighboring states, it's going to really affect that state's economy. The reason I say that is today, the trucking industry transports 72% of the tons of freight that moves in Oregon. Now, freight is projected to double the volume between now and 2020. And the trucking industry's share of that freight is projected to go even higher, somewhere between 76 and 78%. So if we increase the cost of the fuel that we burn, we're going to have that reflected in all of the products and services that we buy, from the loaf of bread in the grocery store to the clothes we wear, even to the paper that my testimony is printed on. That increased fuel cost will be reflected in the prices of those goods, because we're virtually transporting the whole economy. The last point I'd like to make is that the three major truck engine manufacturers, Detroit, Cummins, and Caterpillar, have all told us that they will not honor the warranties of our truck engines if the fault or the defect or whatever happens to the engine is caused by the use of biodiesel. They have not been able to do adequate testing so that they know what kinds of blends, what kinds of standards, all of those kinds of things. So like the railroad testimony that you heard a couple of days ago, our warranties would be void if we used biodiesel. Today's truck engines cost between $25,000 and $30,000 a copy. It would be a tremendous burden if our warranties for those engines were void. And that concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. Good rule. Get off easy. Thank you. All right. We have several folks left. Dan Klim, I believe, is here now. Good. And let me call up Ashley Henry. Are you here? I think we lost a few people from last hearing. And let's say Marv Doty. And Terry Witt. I don't see Terry here either. I think Terry was going to submit some testimony, my written testimony. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Klim. I am the DAS fleet manager. DAS would like to offer that a one-word change be made to Section 3, subsection 2. It requires that DAS meet a requirement of...
Mr. Chair, could you clarify which bill we're talking about?
I'm sorry, House Bill 3034. House Bill 3034, Section 3, Section 2, requires DAS to report a baseline amount of diesel used and then to increase its biodiesel usage 5% over the preceding year for every year thereafter. Within that section, it also allows DAS to incorporate the use of the purchasing volumes used by the school districts. And the word used is subsidized, which infers a financial transaction to some degree. And I've submitted a word change to Mr. Hauser to just change that to include the amount of, which would make it clear that DAS could be allowed to use the purchasing volumes of the school districts in meeting the 5% requirement for every year thereafter. So, again, that's House Bill 3034. Any questions of me? Thank you.
I guess not. Thank you very much. We have one other person that's going to testify, and she is not here yet, but will be, so I think we'll stand at ease temporarily. Jim Welch is not here. Armit, and welcome Mr. Witt, Terry Witt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. I apologize for not having written testimony. I left it back in the office. I was we're up in another meeting trying to work out some amendments to the Glotail bill so we can help with the methamphetamine problem. I'll keep my comments very, very brief. We're in a rather probably unusual situation with regard to the biofuel bills, and that is that we represent such a wide diversity of natural resource folks that we've got people on all sides of this issue, from the small woodland and large corporate foresters who are interested in biomass conversion into energy, to our grain producers on the east side that are looking at production of ethanol from grains, to potentially using canola as a rotational crop, to our valley farmers that are the very high value seed crops in the Mid-Willamette Valley that have considerable concern about particularly contamination of their crops with canola, and have some concerns that hopefully we'll be able to address through the Department of Agriculture and control districts to ensure that there are adequate buffers between crops that are competing for a variety of different reasons. We do, however, support the concept of biofuels and the benefits that can bring to Oregon from a standpoint of potentially clean air and jobs and avenues for agricultural crops and biomass from our forests. These are materials that I think all have potential and all have future if it can be done economically. I would just urge the committee, and I know the committee is going to look at this with due consideration, to make sure that we would not only look at the at what might happen, but take a hard look at the economics of some of these proposals. For example, when we're talking about converting canola seed into biodiesel, there have been a considerable amount of assumptions made with regard to, for example, the yields that can be realistically expected off of growing canola in Oregon, and we've heard numbers in the range of 6,000 pounds per acre. When talking to canola growers on the east side who grow canola for seed in irrigated conditions, I've been told that 2,000 to 2,500 pounds per acre is a good yield. 6,000 is unheard of, at least with the varieties that we know of presently. And couple that with some of the numbers that we've heard with regard to what processors may be willing to pay for canola seed, in the neighborhood of 12 to 13 cents a pound. Currently, you can ship canola from Canada to the Port of Portland, I believe, for about 8.5. They're getting about 8.5 cents per pound in the Port of Portland. So we need to make sure that the economics pencil out and that we're using realistic numbers so that we don't create a system based upon wishes and hopes rather than realities. The last thing that I would like to see happen is farmers incentivized in Oregon to convert existing crops to oilseed crops or some other biofuel type crop only to have no market for their product at a price that can allow them to stay in business. And then we have a collapse, and then we wind up with basically an industry in Oregon that's processing corn from Iowa into ethanol and canola seed from Canada into biofuels, and none of our Oregon farmers are realizing any benefit. Not that that may not be a beneficial way of manufacturing these, but we need to know that going in, and hopefully we're not telling the public and the farmers one thing and then doing a bait and switch and saying, well, to really pencil out the economics, we need to import these materials. So with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions that I might be able to answer, and I wish you well in trying to resolve some of these very complicated issues.
Questions? Let me ask you this. We heard some testimony a little earlier before you were able to be here. I believe there were a total of possibly 1 million acres in the Willamette Valley, 500,000 of which I believe were in seed grain and seed crops. How many acres do we really have available? Because as I'm hearing it, the Willamette Valley is probably not going to be the place that most of this is grown. Might be as a rotational crop for some, but probably not a cash crop that really will make it. How many acres do we have, and how many acres or how much product will it take to feed one of these compression plants? Or
Chair Anderson, that's a very good question, and I honestly don't know the answer to that. And I think a lot of that would obviously be, from my perspective, would be predicated on the yield. If we're able to turn out 1,500 or 2,000 pounds per acre, we would need probably X amount. I think Representative Krupp was using the figure that we would probably need between 200 and 250,000 acres, I think, under production.
Average for one plant?
I don't know that for sure, Mr. Chair. But if that's the point is, if that's the case, and that's based on a yield of let's say 2,000 pounds per acre, if you're able to get 3,000 or 4,000 pounds, you could conceivably divide that acreage in half. The one thing that appears to be appropriate right now is that canola is used primarily as a rotation crop. It's a crop that apparently, because of disease and insect pressure, you can't grow year after year after year. You have to rotate it with something else. There is also, I think, the real potential for development of new crops that potentially would have even higher benefit in the area of oil production that would not represent the same kind of potential cross-contamination of the brassicas family that currently people are worried about in the Willamette Valley. I know they're talking about things like pygmy sunflowers and things of this nature that are high oil-bearing seeds that would not outcross with existing types of crops. So I think the research area is one that hopefully will provide some fruit for us.
Lead to
right.
Product. Any other questions?
Well, I think, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I think so, you can so. Get back to the question and the issue of the concern that I have that I need to have kind of answered. And I think Terry makes an excellent point in terms of what do Oregon farmers have to have per pound in order to make that a viable crop for them. I mean, it's great for them to grow a crop that will do something else, but what do they have to have? And could we be competitive, in growing canola or whatever the crop happens to be? And in terms of corn for ethanol, I don't know how that would necessarily pencil out now, but I know a few years ago the representative from my district, Stafford Hansel, had one of the largest hog operations in the western part of the United States, and we grow some corn over in eastern Oregon, but Stafford said the cheapest feed I can get is Iowa corn. Therefore, it doesn't do, if that's the end sum game that we're playing, okay, maybe we still go ahead and do this, but we need to know on what, who we're helping and who it's a benefit to, rather than just making the kind of blanket assumption that just because it uses a product that we might or might not be able to grow here, that's going to help Oregon farmers. So I appreciated, Terry's comments on that, and that's about the figures that we were looking at and thinking about, before. And I know that in talking with farmers in my district, as I said before, that it's got to be the irrigated canola over there, but the dry land is, we won't get anywhere close to the production that you're talking about that would be needed for it. So, not that it won't, canola won't grow on the dry land, but you just don't get as much of it.
But the minute you irrigate, you drive the price quite a bit higher.
That's true. I mean, so we drive the price up and everything else. It's an interesting set of problems and issues we've got to look at, Mr. Chair. I appreciate your taking the time that you are and putting the energy into it. It's very, it's the only way we're going to get
it. Very informative.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Terry. Mm-hmm. And if you'd like to submit your written testimony.
I will do that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Paul Ashley Henry? Out of breath still? Thanks for being patient.
Thank you. Chairman Anderson and the committee, I do apologize for my tardiness. If it's any consolation, I got out of bed and out of my pajamas exclusively to testify on this issue today. I'm sick, and I'm a little woozy from medication, so if I don't make a lot of sense, I apologize. I am here representing the Oregon Business Association. We represent about 250 Oregon businesses, including Bear Creek Orchards, PacifiCorp, Nike, Northwest Natural, Columbia Sportswear, and many others. I won't read through my testimony because I did already provide an executive summary to your administrator on Tuesday. That's a three-page executive summary of the economic analysis that OBA performed for the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department, specifically on the issue of economic opportunity from the biofuels industry. And I'll confess that we went into this very skeptically. The researcher I worked with himself was a very conservative businessman who was very doubtful at the time that he embarked on this study. And at the conclusion of the study, he's actually himself considering investment, personal investment in the biofuels, the growing industry here in Oregon, because he is quite convinced that it is a considerable opportunity economically, both for the state and for individual investors. The primary driver for this, as you've probably heard, is the need for the ULSD fuel that's going to be required by federal mandate in 2006, and the need for an additional lubricity agent to be put into petroleum diesel. And the current estimate of that is is several hundreds of millions of gallons that are going to be needed across the West Coast, and there are not any large-scale West Coast plants. And so the situation is simply that there's going to be a need for this product, and there is no great source of it, so Oregon could seize this opportunity. And that's why this organization is coming out in support of this bill's package, because we feel like it's an opportunity that shouldn't be missed, and it's just a particular timing that we have to act upon it at this moment. Just want to reiterate that OBA does support the entire package, specifically the Renewable Fuel Standard, the RFS, and also the property tax exemptions for the facilities that are requested. And I'd be happy to answer any questions or follow up with any additional research during your contemplation of these bills. I know there'll probably be some modifications made, and we'd be happy to be a part of those discussions.
And you will distribute the study?
The study, I already gave copies on Tuesday, and then we also have a full printout of the full report, 70 pages of it, on our website if you need a little more reading.
I saw a copy of it, but I didn't know it was out to everybody.
Yeah.
What's the website, please?
Website?
You know. Oh, our website, yes, is www.oba-online.org. And if you scroll to the bottom of the home page, there's a link to the PDF for the report. And I can also provide you with my business card that has the website listed on it as well.
So you're estimating it'll take 200, possibly 300 million gallons? To
fulfill the need on the West Coast as of 2006.
Okay.
Right, not just in Oregon. And the fact is that we could actually be a supplier for other states if we were proactive about this.
Are there other facilities going in Washington? Or
There's some siting that's been proposed in a number of areas, yes. But given the demand that will result from these new federal mandates, one facility alone is not going to fulfill that demand.
Okay. All right. Any questions, Ashley?
Thank you for waiting for me. I apologize for my tardiness.
Hope you're feeling better.
Thanks.
All right. Anyone else in the audience would like to comment or question? If not, thank you all for attending, and we'll close the hearing. And we are adjourned.